we are what we eat, then the reverse must be true as well, and feeding problems in infants and children can present real hazards to their growth and development. But who is at risk for these types of feeding issues, and what can be done about it? Well, joining me this morning to explore these questions is Heather Cady, an instructor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University and a clinician with the Family Behavior Analysis Clinic, where she treats a wide range of children with feeding disorders. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, can you define a feeding disorder for me?
Absolutely.
How do you know if a child has one?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate between an eating and a feeding disorder, because when people hear feeding disorder, they automatically think eating disorder, including diagnosis such as bulimia or anorexia.
Exactly.
This is a feeding disorder is very different, and it typically affects younger children. Most of the children that we see are between the age range of 2 to 4 years old, and it's difficult for people to imagine that there's young children that just would refuse to eat, but there is a small population of children that actually will, from different levels of severity, refuse to eat.
So the major distinction then between the feeding disorder, so to speak, and the eating disorder is really the age of the person we're talking about?
Partly, but it's also how the disorder develops. I'm not an expert in anorexia or bulimia, but there's more of a psychological basis, I would imagine, for those disorders. Whereas with the feeding disorders, often the children experience some type of discomfort or a pain associated with eating, and they actually will stop eating or refuse to eat. And that's part of it. There's other ways that the feeding disorder can develop, but that's an example of how it might come about.
So it's like a food aversion of some kind.
Right.
They find there's something about eating that turns them off.
Exactly.
Okay, well, how is that different from having a so-called picky eater? I mean, that's certainly something anyone who's been a parent has run across or knows of.
Right. Well, there's a continuum of severity, and there's some children, the most severe children are those that have a feeding tube. These children will not eat anything by mouth, no food, no liquid, and they typically get all the nutrition through a tube. A gastrostomy tube is surgically placed through the abdominal wall. And clearly that child is not a picky eater. They don't eat anything by mouth. But it becomes a little bit more difficult with the children that are more selective eaters. Those are the less severe children, where they may only eat a select number of foods. But if the child is consuming enough calories to maintain an appropriate weight, it's hard to really decipher whether or not that's an issue, if it's just selectivity. But if the child's not eating any fruits or vegetables, if they're not eating one whole group of food, then that may be an indication that it's a feeding disorder. Or if the child is perhaps eating a wide variety of foods, but they only eat a certain texture. Maybe they're 3 years old and they only eat pureed foods or smooth texture foods. Another example would be inappropriate or unusual mealtime behavior, where the child is 3 years old and might drink milk, but only out of a bottle. So those are all examples of children that we've seen that have a problem. So it affects them getting adequate nutrition, or if it's inappropriate mealtime conditions, things like that.
So what are the overall effects of this type of problem? I mean, you've alluded to the most severe circumstances where someone actually has to insert a tube into them to provide them with nutrition. But generally, what are the harmful effects? Let's say someone who's more selective and has a feeding problem, but they're more selective rather than completely, abhors food.
Well, as far as growth, one of the primary concerns is adequate nutrition, getting a wide variety of nutrition for the child. Some of these kids come in and all they eat is chicken fingers and french fries. We had one little boy where all he ate, he was 6 years old, 4 things. And his primary source of food was SpaghettiOs. And he ate no vegetables, and the only fruit he ate was applesauce. So you can imagine a child that's eating such a selective group of foods is not going to get adequate nutrition to grow. And a very important effect to consider, too, is the families. This particular family, the little boy who only ate 4 foods, they couldn't travel. They couldn't be spontaneous or be somewhere and pick up something for the child to eat because he only ate such a selective number of things. Or if you go to your family's house and your family doesn't have SpaghettiOs, you know, for Thanksgiving or Christmas and all these holidays. So there's a huge social impact on that as well, or children going to birthday parties, or imagine having a one-year-old and your child doesn't eat birthday cake.
So it's interesting. So it has, what you're saying, it's really kind of a bifurcated in the sense that it can obviously and most critically affect the individual child.
Absolutely.
But it also has major ramifications for their larger social network.
Yep.
And maybe how they're responded to or how they're welcomed or all kinds of other things. Well, tell me, who are the kinds of kids that you usually see? Who's prone most, if you can make generalizations, who are most prone to these problems?
Well, it's an interesting question for me because this is the third program that I've worked at. And I worked at the Marcus Institute in Atlanta, and I worked at the Monroe Meyer Institute in Omaha, and of course here. And each place I've worked, there's been a concentration of different populations. For example, here, so far, all of the children that I've seen have had a diagnosis of autism. And in Atlanta, only about 10% of the children that we saw had a diagnosis of autism. And the majority of children that we saw in Atlanta had a history of failure to thrive or gastroesophageal reflux disorder. And in Omaha, we worked very closely with the intestinal rehabilitation program over there. So the majority of the kids we saw there had short bowel syndrome. So I've worked with children with a variety of different diagnoses. A lot of them in the other programs have had complicated medical histories, whereas here the children don't have that complicated medical history but have the diagnosis of autism.
I'm going to have you hold that thought because we're going to have to take a short break.
Okay.
And we'll be right back to continue this conversation. It's fascinating. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio, 106.9 and 570 WSYR. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with Heather Cady, a clinician with Upstate's Family Behavior Analysis Clinic, where she treats children with feeding issues. Well, before the break, we were talking about the kinds of kids that you see, or that you've seen here, but the kinds of kids that have this kind of problem. So children with autism will have them. Children with physical problems like GERD, G-E-R-D, which is the gastrointestinal, what was that?
Gastroesophageal reflux disorder.
Right. Kids who are premature. Tell me some of the other kids that you might see, that, or not that you might see, but that do seem to tend to have these kinds of feeding issues.
Well, the ones that you mentioned are probably include the majority of children that we've seen. As I mentioned, we saw a number of children with short bowel syndrome. Because at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, they had a clinic over there that was designed specifically to treat those kids, and we had a lot of referrals from that program.
Okay, so kids who have some kids who actually have problems chewing or swallowing also could be
absolutely
at risk for this kind of thing, and generally kids with developmental delays. Right?
Yes,
for
absolutely.
Any reason.
Yep.
Great. Well, tell me what you think affects food preference. I mean, obviously, there are some kids who only have, as you mentioned before the break, two or three things they'll eat or four things they'll eat. What are the kinds of things that play a role in what they choose?
That's a good, interesting question. And I've actually been getting a little bit more involved in exploring that lately. And it's hard to know how a child ends up only eating four foods and why it is those specific four foods. For the children that have a diagnosis of autism, we know that they're very structured and resistant to change, and that might play a role in why some children with autism have a very selective diet. But why the specific foods, it's hard to know. But there's an article in a pediatric journal, and this has been reported in other places, that through exposure is how we begin to develop preferences. A lot of people are kind of under the assumption that I was born liking what I like and that's what I eat, but it doesn't actually develop like that. There's certainly genetic factors. We're predisposed to liking certain foods.
Whether it's salty or sweet.
Exactly. And why you might see a lot of kids that may only eat chicken fingers and fries. But we're also affected by what we're exposed to in an environment, which is part of culture, what our parents present to us. And you can affect food preference by exposing kids repeatedly to foods. And that's where my job is to develop a set of rules where the child is consistently getting exposure to a variety of foods.
If there are real physical issues, though, in terms of chewing, swallowing, that kind of thing, makes more sense why you might have trouble with certain kinds of textures or that kind of thing. So we'll get into the treatment. So your goal would be to help them compensate in some way for whatever their limitations are in terms of the physical limitations as
right.
well.
We certainly have to take that into consideration, and that's part of the interdisciplinary approach. And ideally, you want to have somebody who has been able to evaluate the child's oral motor skills, an occupational therapist or speech therapist, to know what's reasonable, what's within that child's skill set, what can they do. And I need that information to be able to say, okay, here's what we expect the child to do. But we have to make sure when we're asking the child to do something that they don't want to do, that what we're asking them to do is very reasonable and within their skill set.
So getting back to this, just giving an overarching kind of approach, you basically do an analysis or an evaluation using multidisciplinary team. People, like you said, occupational speech therapists perhaps, medical people. Tell me some of the other players.
We also include nutrition. We need to know if you have a child that's eating four foods, what are they getting nutritionally, and what foods are going to be ideal for us to work on.
So you set a target.
Exactly. And ideally, we might only start with four foods, and you want to make sure that those four foods start to fill the nutrition holes in the child's diet. Occupational speech therapy, as you mentioned earlier, too, a lot of times children come about with feeding issues as a result of swallow dysfunction. And we need to make sure that any medical cause for the child's feeding problem is resolved before we go in and start to do intensive behavioral treatment, because if there's still some ongoing physical problem, that could make the issue worse for the child.
So here's the segue. Ongoing behavioral approach or intensive approach. Tell me, how is it that you make these changes in someone's behavior? What's your overarching principle?
Well, as I mentioned, is what my job is to come up with a set of rules under which the child will consistently eat or drink whatever it is they need to be eating or drinking.
What does that mean?
Set of rules. So Well, let me go back a little bit to start. What we initially want to do is come up with an initial set of rules for the child to consistently eat. For example, we might use a gradual procedure. For example, we might say, okay, we're working on peas, and all we want the child to do is to have a pea on the spoon, to pick it up and put it back down. Something very, very easy for the child to do. And then we provide reinforcement.
So you set objectives. And then you reinforce.
This is an example of a procedure that we might use.
Yeah.
And then we would gradually work up to the child eating the food, kind of like systematic desensitization. The next step might be the child to pick up the spoon, touch their tongue to it, and then we would provide reinforcement. And then based on their success, we would continue to increase the requirements.
So it's very Skinnerian in the sense. I mean, it's based on the B.F. Skinner concepts of stimulus response reinforcement. Is that correct?
In some cases, yes. And really, it's based on, there's a lot of things involved because it's feeding and it involves a lot of, involves oral motor and nutrition. But the underlying principles is applied behavior analysis, which is simply principles of learning, how we all learn. Children learn in the same way that we learn, but we set up an environment that's very predictable for the child, make it easier for them to learn what the expectations are in the meal. And we also start with something that's very simple, making it easy for them to comply or become successful. And I think what happens a lot of times, parents try a lot of really great things at home to get their child to eat, but what they do is they they try something very dramatic or very big instead of starting with something small. And if they took that same idea and scaled it down and started with something very simple, some of the things that they would try at home might be more effective. For example, I think of my sister. She was trying to get her daughter to drink milk out of a sippy cup. She's 14 months, and she was drinking milk out of a bottle, wanted to transition her. Every time she tried to get her to drink out of the sippy cup, she would throw it on the floor. She was very disruptive. And so one thing that we tried is taking a different cup, a different sippy cup, a colored cup, and she would drink water out of a cup. And we put primarily water in the cup and about 10% milk. And she took it fine. So as opposed to going from 0 to 60, from no milk to milk, is fading it and using what the child's already successful with and then building on that, which is a lot of what we do in treatment as well, is where will the child, what will the child do, what can they do successfully, and then can we blend foods, can we gradually fade foods. There's been a procedure that we've used where there was a child who would drink milk, but wouldn't drink milk out of a cup, but would accept it off of a spoon. And they used a procedure where they actually taped the cup onto the spoon and gradually faded the cup closer to the child's mouth until the child was drinking milk out of a cup. Again, starting with something the child is successful and then gradually fading to something that's more appropriate or age appropriate.
So it's very much a stepwise kind of approach to
learning. Yes, many of the procedures that we do are, yes.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like you do an analysis, you figure out what the causes are, what the needs are, you set treatment goals, you set kind of nutritional goals and specific objectives, and then you really, in very, very slow and steady steps, right, try to achieve these.
Right.
So what happens? Does it work?
It does work. We're actually very successful. And one of the things that makes us very successful is using a database approach. We always have one person in our observation room collecting data, and we always have one person in the feeding room. And we collect data on up to 20 different variables of behavior. So we take data on if the child is coughing, are they gagging, did they accept the food, how quickly did they accept it, did they pack it, did they swallow it, did they spit it out? Did they throw up? And we're collecting data on those things throughout all of the sessions. We put those on a graph, and then we look at our graphs to be able to tell whether or not we're making progress. And using behavior analysis involves learning. The child needs to learn, and that takes time, and it's a gradual process, and it's very difficult to know whether or not if you're having a treatment effect, unless you can see that over time. And putting that information on a graph allows us to see if we are making progress.
Well, it sounds to me like you have a very structured approach.
Yes.
And one that seems to work. And obviously, we're running out of time, but parents really have to play a very significant role. So you have to train the parents,
yes,
how to take this kind of approach home and reinforce it and do it on a daily basis, several,
absolutely,
times a day,
yes,
which is critically important. Well, it sounds like it's working, and it sounds very exciting. Heather Cady, instructor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University and feeding disorder clinician. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We really enjoyed hearing all about your program. We have to take another short break, but we'll be right back with more HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.